Please be seated or stand quietly. I would like to welcome Sea Alaska. Thank you for being gracious enough to agree to come and meet the public again. You always get grilled pretty well in Sitka, but I want to keep this on the upswing, and I will make sure that the questions are polite once we get started, but I'm going to turn the mic over to you, Mr. Harris, and you can introduce all the different folks that are here, the map giver, too. Okay, so, anyway, welcome and please. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Mayor. My name is Rick Harris. I'm the Executive Vice President for Sea Alaska Corporation. I've been with Sea Alaska since 1980. Prior to that, I was actually one of the fisheries biologists at the Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. So it's good to see Pete here because I've known Pete a long time in the aquaculture business. I didn't know you were on the assembly. Congratulations. I brought more people with me this time because I think I read a blog that said that I was a windbag. So I thought, okay, I got that message, so we will bring some more people to tell us, to kind of fill in a little bit more on Sea Alaska. So to my left is Jaylene Arujo. She's our Vice President and General Counsel. She served as Sea Alaska's part of our legal team, lobby team in Washington, D.C. for about 10 years and has been out here with Sea Alaska for 2 years. Time flies. It's me. I'm getting older, so I'm the one trying to. And Jaylene was a scholarship recipient from Sea Alaska, an intern with Sea Alaska, and then received her legal degree and did legal work in Washington, D.C., and is now back with us as our general counsel. Then to the left of Jaylene is Russell Dick. He's the president and CEO of the new subsidiary we created called Ha'ani. On the handout that we gave you, you'll see how Ha'ani is spelled. It's a Tlingit word and basically means our land. This is where we're from. This is our place. This is where our relatives are from, our culture, our heritage. And so Russell is also a scholarship recipient and an intern and everything else from Sea Alaska. I wasn't sure was going to make it, but has actually become an incredible part of our management team. Also with me is Dixie Hutchinson, who is in our corporate communications in the back, and William Andrews is, he's taking the photographs. I couldn't tell, I thought maybe he was the newspaper. I wanted to just provide a little quick overview of Sea Alaska. It's, I think it's always useful to revisit it. We're one of the, I'm being reminded on the protocol here. First of all, we want to thank the Assembly for giving this opportunity to talk. And also we want to thank the tribal leaders of Sitka and the clans of Sitka for allowing us to come to their community and to talk about Sea Alaska and things that are important to both us and them. So to that degree, we are very appreciative of the clans that were here and the warm reception that we receive when we come here. What I'd like to do is just give you a little bit of an overview. We have about 1,500 shareholders that live in Sitka. That represents about 19% of your total population. Those shareholders bring a lot of benefits from Sea Alaska to your community. In the last 10 years, we've distributed over almost $10 million in 7i payments, dividends, distributions, to the stockholders that are tribal member shareholders that reside in this community. We continue to provide payments that run somewhere in the $800 to $1 million a year on average is what we see. We've also we've awarded about done a number of scholarships with 96 individual in Sitka have awarded educational scholarships for about $162,000. So, we're a, The corporation is very much dedicated to education and training and advancing people. Both Russell and Jaylene are Stanford graduates. Russell has his MBA from Stanford. Jaylene, I don't like Stanford. Jaylene also has her JD from, University of New Mexico. And again, we've continually pushed education and scholarships at virtually every area in order to be able to grow our shareholder base and for our shareholders to take over the company. I'm not a shareholder. I came to the company in 1980. At that point in time, the most senior ranking person on the management team was the HR, the vice president of HR was a shareholder, and everybody else were non-natives. At this point in time, there's probably three non-natives that are in the executive team. The CEO is a tribal member shareholder. The CFO is not. The treasurer, corporate secretary, all of our major accounting departments, our corporate secretary, have all been able to step up and assume those positions. So. This is a little bit of kind of like walking down memory lane, and it's important that we do that because so often we see the here and now and we forget what things look like 30 or 40 years ago. And so I just want to say that, you know, I'm proud of being at SeaAlaska, and I'm proud of those very much those kind of accomplishments. From Sitka, we've had some very important leaders. Mark Jacobs sat on the SeaAlaska board, was a very pivotal leader in helping set a solid foundation for SeaAlaska. John Hope Jr. and Charlie Carlson, all from Sitka, have been members of our board. They're all deceased now, as I say, their legacy and the things they've done have been very important. We want to talk about, other than giving you a little bit of an overview, The interest of being in Sitka is that this is where ANCSA in many ways almost started. And the AMB Camp 1 was here, and it was where ANCSA really got started. Now, it wasn't called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act then. It was just simply people stepping together and saying we need to begin to organize and to be an effective voice for the advancement and the protection of the interests of our people. And I think that Sitka has that, as a badge of honor in the fact that the leadership that was here had the gumption to step up and to go against a lot of things that were contrary to those views. And so we always hold Sitka a little bit dear to our heart. We've held our annual meetings here and have had a great time. And I can tell you I've left a lot of money here. So I feel we have an invested interest here. One of the things that we wanted to talk about a little bit more is what SeaAlaska is doing and what it can do. I've sort of provided just some of the benefits and the dividends. We really don't own any companies here. We have offered and have engaged with the chamber, with the Sitka Economic Development Council or Association, I never get it right, CETA anyhow, and with both the mayor and the city manager at times and offered to say we really believe we want to make investments here, we want to be part of the community in a larger way than we are right now, and we've offered to sit down in more of a strategic planning session to understand what the community's goals and desires are in terms of the types of industries and businesses that they would like to see here. And then for SeaAlaska to be able to look at it and say, okay, can we possibly do that? Are there places where things match up? We did at one time spend a little bit of time looking at a call center, and one of our CEOs met with the mayor at that time, and we talked about the idea of actually establishing a call center in Sitka. It didn't come to fruition for a variety of reasons. But again, that was one of those things where it was, IT technology kind of an opportunity. But the strategy and of what we've seen is how do we build that relationship with the community of Sitka and the residents of Sitka to create an economic base and to have a stronger economic presence. And with that, I want to turn it over to Russell to explain why and how we think Ha'ani is a place and maybe a way that we can work with the community.
Thank you, Rick. Madam Mayor, Assembly, it's a pleasure to be here. You know, Rick made a comment about, you know, when I was an intern, he was worried that I wasn't going to make it, and I turned out okay. But the reason I almost didn't make it is because when I was an intern, he had me crawling up and down fish streams, counting gravel and rocks and everything else while bears were out there feeding. And I walked in one day and said, we need to change the program or I'm out of here. But anyway, as Rick said, my name is Russell Dick. I am the president and CEO of Haanee. And to me, it's an exciting opportunity for me. I've been in the position since, well, August of last year, and I transitioned out of corporate development for the remainder of the year and really started in this full time in January. And, you know, I grew up in Hoonah, so my entire childhood there. My father, some of you may know if you've been around a long time, Albert Dick, passed away in April, but was mayor emeritus for the community, was chairman of Hoonah Totem Corporation for 20-something years. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of following in his footsteps, being the chairman of Hoonah Totem Corporation myself now. And, you know, over growing up as a child in Hoonah, I mean, I really had the opportunity to grow up in an environment where you understood what ANCSA meant to a lot of tribal member shareholders. And I grew up in a time where our culture and our heritage was strong in that community. We had a lot of economic development, a lot of opportunity, and people didn't have to worry day to day whether or not they were going to buy groceries today or buy fuel instead. And those were great times. And I've had the opportunity to go back now, and I've got a lot of friends who now send their kids to Mount Edgecombe because they're worried about the school system in Hoonah. And it's great kind of for you all here, but a little disconcerting for some of us who live in the community of Hoonah. So having the opportunity to come back and work on this side of Sea Alaska and take this on, recognizing that it's going to be a significant challenge, was very important to me, and I'm really looking forward to it. Now, just taking a step back, really this Haanee is predicated on the board's desire to really look at issues like out-migration from our rural communities. Again, it's an issue of culture and heritage, and a lot of us believe, and I believe personally, that our culture and our heritage really resides in our traditional rural communities. And we believe Sitka is one of those communities. And if we don't do something to help address the economic issues in a number of these communities, as you all, I'm sure, know here in Sitka as well, then, you know, we're going to continue to see a population decline and significant issues that come with that. So the board said, look, I mean, we've been on management asking you guys to look at Southeast Alaska and the region for a number of years. you know, people get stretched thin with everything else that Sea Alaska does outside the region. And in 2009, they said, look, we're going to help you out. They established Haanee. Its sole focus is economic development and sustainability in Southeast Alaska. And they capitalized it with $5 million with an expectation that we would leverage that with another $8 million. And a key to that is there's an expectation that we will have $2 million come from outside sources and partnerships. And I think that's critical to the initiative as we continue to go forward, because Sea Alaska, I mean, we can bring a lot of assets to this issue and help generate economic opportunities in these communities. But we all recognize that we can't do this by ourselves either. That this is going to be something where we need to come in, as Rick talked about, sit down with the community and understand what your assets are, what your priorities are, where you think economic foundation can start, and work with you in that regard. The last thing we want to do, or the last thing I want to do, is walk into one of our rural communities and say, Sea Alaska's here, we're going to solve your problems, here's what you need to do. Because that isn't going to work long term, that's not sustainable for us. But if we can walk into a community and somebody says, I've got this great idea, but I've got this hurdle, I can't get access to capital, I can't get access to financing, then that's a place that we can help. But at the end of the day, that business is an entrepreneurial activity that belongs to that shareholder. And I'll give you one example, oyster mariculture. We went out and see that as a viable opportunity across the entire region. And a number of people, a number of tribal member shareholders want to undertake that activity but don't have access to capital. And so we said, that's easy enough. I mean, we went out, we bought basically high-end, technologically advanced infrastructure and put it in a couple places and entered into agreements with shareholders and now said, that's your business. Now you're responsible for growing out high quality, high class, pristine water oysters that we can sell into the marketplace. But there are places that we can help in addition to financing and capital. We can come in and ensure that you have access to seed. You know, we can buy that in quantities large enough to give us the right rates that help our entrepreneurs succeed from an economic standpoint. And then on the back end, we've got access to markets, and we can help in the distribution and the marketing aspect of their oysters. And that allows them to focus purely on growing very good oysters. And the program is really taking off. We've got apprentices in Cake. We've got 6 shareholders in Yakutat that have oyster farms. Just signed agreements in Angoon, looking at Hoonah and Kluwak. And that's just one example where we get out and say, you know, what do you want to do and how can we help? And then on the flip, you've got another side of this where we partnered with Cake Tribal Corporation. Many of you may have heard we basically refurbished the Cake fish plant in Cake. And it was a huge undertaking for us, but we saw it as an opportunity to partner with a village corporation who really wanted to generate economic development in a community that is hit hard by out-migration and lack of economic opportunities. Now, it's not something, you know, it's not a situation where we want to go out and compete with the big guys in the industry. Our interest isn't there. But if we can create a little niche where communities can operate and they can do something that's traditional, something that they're used to doing, something they've done in the past, and help them tweak, you know, some business plan, bring in some managerial expertise, and it may be something that can work. And, you know, time will tell. We're coming up to the end of the season to see whether or not, you know, this is something we can do going forward. But we put 25 to 30 people to work in the community of Cake. And to me, that's a huge success for that community. Now, it's a seasonal job, but it's something better than they had before. But again, that is coming in, providing capital, providing some managerial expertise, but saying this is on you. This is your opportunity. And we didn't have to bring in people from the outside. 99.5% of the hire in that fish plant is local hire from that community. And to me, that's successful. And those are the kinds of things that we can do. But again, it's about partnerships and it's about collaboration. So that, Madam Mayor, just kind of an overview of some of the things that we're doing. And I'm looking forward to working with the community of Sitka as well as you look at opportunities here. I remember coming down here for a number of years, you know, in sports, and I came down for the Sitka Legion basketball tournament a number of years, and I love it down here and never get the opportunity really to come back, but I'm looking forward to working with you all and seeing if there are any places that we can partner. So thank you.
So, Madam Mayor, sorry. What you have is that's, you know, again, is a sincere expression from Sea Alaska of an interest of working with the community. We have issues before us that are divisive, but you know that those things said, we're still prepared to work past those issues. We believe that there are other opportunities for work together. So there's some cases we're going to agree to disagree, perhaps. In other cases, we want to work together. We don't hold, you know, we think that there are opportunities. I want to give you now just a little bit, because we're going to move a little bit to land, which is always where the issue starts to come up. And you've received a couple of things. You have some maps, and for the audience, these maps are all in the back. I'll hold it up. This is the kind of the large area map. And on this map, this one is in front of the members. And I'll just go through this map real quickly just to sort of highlight it, because what we've done is we've put virtually everything that's going on with Sea Alaska in terms of land that's already been conveyed to us or sites that are pending conveyance to us and also land that we've identified under the federal land legislation. What you see in the red dots, and these dots, by the way, are not to scale. These sites are like 1, 5, 3 acres. That dot is probably closer to about 5,000 or 10,000 acres. So the dot is just to help you locate it, because if we put it to scale, you wouldn't see it. So what you see on this map are red dots. Those sites have already been conveyed to us, and these are all 14H1 sites, which is a provision of ANCSA that allows us to select a certain number of cultural and cemetery sites. And so we have received title to those through the 14H1 process. The blue dots are examples of locations under the federal legislation. If we were able to make additional sacred site or future site, I'm sorry, native cultural and cemetery site selections, those would be some of the areas that we would consider for selection. These are indeed documented native cultural properties with extensive amount of reconnaissance work around it. There's another thing that looks like a small building. This is something called those are the green boxes, and this is again is in the federal land legislation, and what we call those is the Native Future Sites. People ask what is the idea behind the Native Future Sites, and there was a point in time that they created the Tongass Futures Roundtable, and it was really an effort to try to bring some stability to the economic and timber base of the region. Not just timber, but it was really kind of a timber and beyond type of operation or goal. And our director said, all right, we're committed to that too. We're going to identify some parcels of ground scattered throughout Southeast that we will take conveyance to. We will commit not to harvest timber or to develop resources on it, but we will work with the rural communities and urban communities to develop other kinds of alternative economic enterprise. I just sat on the JEDC cluster group and listened to some of the tourism people talk about how frustrating they are, and I'm not picking on the Forest Service, but their system for permits is complicated, costly, frustrating, and I think no matter who you talk to in the industry, there's delays, there's frustration, there's uncertainty. And one of the examples they had was this is somebody with a canoe rowing across Mendenhall Lake, and the canoe seats 15 people. And she has a 15-person van that delivers them. The Forest Service deemed that you can only have so many visitors on the Mendenhall Lake, so the canoe can only go across with 9 people. And the van can only have 9 people in it. They're still driving. She would still drive the same van. She would still paddle the same canoe. But they limited the number of people. So now that makes it very difficult for them to have an economic operation. And so what we did is we just heard people saying we've got to be able to get past some of these things and see if we can't create some new economic enterprise. And that's what the future sites were about. So I'm just putting those and trying to get everything in the reference on the map, and we'll come back and revisit this. The other thing that you see on this map is these large yellow blocks. We own the subsurface to that land. The surface owner is a native corporation, a village or an urban corporation. You have another map, which is a little bit larger scale map, which just sort of helps you see the yellows, because in some cases they're not as easy to see. But you see the large block here, and then I also remind you that there's some yellow down here in Section 18, down in this area, and a little bit of yellow up here in these islands. And again, we're just the subsurface owner. The surface owner is a village or urban corporation in the Sitka area. So these two maps are really intend to give you a frame of reference. Now there's a couple other sites that we have pending, and these are the orange dots, and there's two of them. One we'll talk further about is Redoubt Lake, which is where the blowout is. These sites were, the request for conveyance was submitted in 1976 to the BLM, and these were under the original ANCSA, and they are the 14H1 sites. The other site that we have pending is Jamboree Bay, which is located in down further south from Redoubt. So these two maps kind of give you an indication of the land ownership. I will point out in the larger area map up towards Sitka Bay, you will see some pink. That's the Alaska owns the fee title to that, both the surface and the subsurface. And that came to us through the village selection at Angoon, and then we were able to select along the shore of Sitka Bay. So you have those items in front of you, just as these are points of reference. What we would like to do now, though, is really to step in and talk specifically about yes, why don't you? She's reminding me I'm off script already. So.
Well, just by way of background on 14H1, I guess I'll introduce myself first. Jaylene Arujo, Vice President and General Counsel with Sea Alaska. I just wanted to give a little bit more background on 14H1, which is a part of the original ANCSA legislation. Most of the land that was conveyed under ANCSA, which is about 44,000 acres in total, 44 million, sorry, acres in total, was conveyed under other sections of ANCSA. They included 42 million in all the other sections. There's 2 million that they put in a pool in 14H of ANCSA. And 14H1 is the section that allows native corporations to select sites that have a different type of value, that is historical or cultural value. These are cemetery and historical sites, and there was a deadline by which we had to make these selections. So that is why the selections for Readout and Jamboree were done back in 1976. So these were part of our original ANCSA requests under 14H1 of ANCSA. And unfortunately, the BIA and the BLM takes a long time to review some of these requests. The other sites we have around Sitka were received back in 1999, and some as recent as 2007. But these ones are still pending, and you have heard about Readout because it's finally at the process, at the point of the BLM process where they start to provide public notice because they're going through the surveying process of identifying the exact boundaries of the site, as well as figuring out if there are pre-existing uses and easements that need to be recognized in the deed if conveyed to Sea Alaska. So right now they're in that process of surveying and identifying pre-existing rights and uses on the property. All of the 14H1 sites and any other ANCSA land that we receive with a deed that most of which have recognition of pre-existing rights. There are sections in ANCSA that require the BLM to recognize pre-existing uses and rights in our deeds when we receive conveyance. So that's the part of the process that's going on now with Readout. And once they complete that surveying and identify all the easements that they need to be included, then they'll provide, again, a public notice of the exact boundaries and the easements that will be recognized. And eventually there'll be a conveyance or a patent of the site. There is a process for appeal. The Forest Service, as an agency that would basically be having they'll basically lose the land as the federal landowner, has the ability to appeal and disagree with the findings of the BIA and the BLM in conveying the property. We've had a few of those in the past that we have gone through appeal, and we've also had sites that we've lost in the past and then appealed and won them. So there is a process for appealing and adjudicating the conveyance of these sites. So I just wanted to make sure people understood it is a process. Unfortunately, this one has been a very lengthy one. And the BIA first has to make the determination that there is there is enough evidence to identify this as a cultural property, and then it goes to the BLM for the surveying process. So wanted to make sure you had some information on the 14H1 conveyancing process.
Thank you.
Jaylene, what we wanted to do is, because there's been confusion, we've read the press, and we kind of view this a little bit of an opportunity to educate people specifically about Readout and the 14H1 process that we went through, which was the original provisions of ANCSA. We're separating that from our land bill, which doesn't affect Readout or Jamboree Bay. Those are things that occurred way in the past. The land legislation we'll also give you an update on. There's an opinion or belief that some people have felt that the site was a Russian site. Readout was just a Russian site, and the Tlingit had never used or occupied that site. And what we do is we have a fair amount of archaeological and ethnographic data to go through and talk about what was the historic and use of that site. And people that were knowledgeable at this time were interviewed, James Williams, Tom Young Sr., Mr. George Lewis, if I didn't say his name, all have been interviewed at various times and reflecting on and reporting their knowledge of the site as well as collection of historic data. A couple of key things, and we don't need to go into it, but first of all, it does have a native name, and it's called Kuna. And that's that readout site has a specific name. It was named for an individual. There's a story that he couldn't catch fish there, crawled up a mountain and turned to stone, and so they named the site after this individual. So there's actually a Tlingit story about this individual, and apparently you can tell where he exists on that site. The Russians recognized it. We have the governor of Russia in 1825-1830. This is in the comments that he made. Said that, you know, the fish run into the lake here is so abundant that it supplies all those who live there the whole winter and is known by them. So, I mean, this is clearly, you know, Tlingit usage and occupancy. They said Redoubt is located and lies in their heart. I mean, this is the Russians' words, the Russian governor at that point in time. We have things that the name suggests that Lisianski incorporated the knowledge that the bay was of exceptional value to the leading men or principal of the clan of the Sitka clan, and they recognized that the Kiksotis were the rightful owner. And to that day, this is recognized that the Kiksotis are the rightful owner. The information kind of continues and goes on and on about the Russian recognition. The Tlingits continually trying to exert their right to be there, to fish at those locations. They protested the Baranof Packing Company was there. They were protesting their fishing and harvesting practices at that point in time. And that was and they were actually sending letters to President Cleveland at that point in time, again expressing concerns. So what you see in these sites, and I sort of use it as a bad story, but, you know, it's like when the 800-pound gorilla comes into the room, where does he sit? You know, it's like anywhere he wants. And that's basically what the Russians did here. They came, they saw the opportunity. They needed the resource. They took it. They used it. They occupied the site. So the Russians, we don't disagree, also used the site. There's been a lot of occupancy there. The paper that we provided for you here is more of a short narration of Redoubt. It's about the Redoubt Bay. It talks about the Russian arrival, their use, you know, what the about, you know, the Tlingit use. And then, as Jaylene had highlighted, it sort of goes through the sequence of the process of where we are and the conveyance of this site. And if you look at the right-hand column and look at the 14H1 statement, the first thing that has to happen is get the site surveyed after we filed for the request for application, which was filed properly in 1976. It now has got to get surveyed. So we're at bullet point item number one. We've got 9 more points to go through before that site gets conveyed, and number 10 is there still an opportunity or potential for appeal. So this is a process, and it's a process that is an administrative process, but also has a quasi-judicial part of that process in terms of if the people decide, and you know, the Forest Service or others choose to appeal. The process also will involve the designation of conservation easements. But public access easements and other easements, and also recognition of prior existing rights that may exist. For example, there's a fish weir on that site. We fully expect that will be an easement. It's been there. It was there after we put in the request for conveyance. But it is there. We expect that'll have an easement, and it will continue to operate as long as the easement holder wants to have a fish weir at that site. So I wanted to just provide you kind of a sequence or a schedule of what this process is to give you a sense of where we are in the process. And the most frustrating thing for all of us is it moves so slowly. It's glacial that it's almost like you feel like something's happening when nothing is happening. You know, it's just this very slow process, and so I know people are concerned, and we're here to, you know, at least highlight the process as we understand it, as the BLM is telling us this is how they're going to process this. So I wanted to highlight that for you. We're going to do one last thing, and then we're going to kind of then throw it back to you if we're okay, Madam Mayor.
Sure.
Okay. We'd like to talk a little bit about our land legislation, and Jaylene's going to kind of highlight what the points are, but I want to go back and do just a little bit of a reminder. We came to Sitka. We had nine future sites that we had identified in the Sitka area that we proposed would be included in the land legislation. And after meeting with the city, the mayors, virtually everybody, the fishermen, the conservation groups, we eliminated seven of them. We took out Kalinin Bay, Goddard Hot Springs. I still see that some people think that Goddard Hot Springs is in the equation. It's not. Big Bay is out, Sturgis Narrows is out, Poison Cove is out, False Island is out, and Crab Bay is out. So they all, by virtue of us coming to the community, we went through and pretty soon started Xing out those sites. So at this point in time in that Sitka area on that map, we have one or two site, two future sites. We also engaged a little bit with the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association because the Hidden Falls Hatchery is happening to be built on an extremely old site. And so that was a site we'd actually identified for possible conveyance. After considerable conversations with the Forest Service, with the NSRA, we also dropped that site as a possible sacred site conveyance. It was not a future site conveyance. So we've continued to try to work with the community to try to reach some adjustments, but still to be able to build a little bit more of an economic and a land presence in the region. So with that, I would like to maybe have Jaylene give you what we know about the land bill.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, Assembly. I just wanted to give you an update on status, because I know we've been working on this for a long time, but we're now in our third Congress, where a Sea Alaska land entitlement bill is pending. Just for a general overview, the Sea Alaska Land Entitlement Bill is to complete our remaining ANCSA entitlement. It's not a land exchange. It's land that is still owed to us under ANCSA. There's about 75,000 acres that we still should receive, I say about or approximately, because there is a calculation that has to play out, so we don't know the exact number, but it's roughly 75,000 acres. We have two bills that are pending in the current Congress. They are Senate Bill 730 and H.R. 1408, introduced by our delegation with bipartisan co-sponsors. This time around is the farthest along that we've gotten in comparison to previous Congresses, because we've actually had a hearing in both houses as well as a passage out of the House Committee. Which occurred back in July, 34-10 vote. The House did move forward the bill, and once the committee report is done, it could be considered on the floor or packaged as part of a land bill in the House. The Senate bill has only had a hearing. We have not yet had passage out of the Senate committee. There is ongoing discussion between Senator Murkowski and Chairman Bingaman, as well as their staffs, on when they will take up public land bills again. They're focused on other issues, energy issues, and other budgetary issues in the Congress. So public lands is not necessarily the highest priority in terms of Congress's priorities to get some legislation done. But if we get a markup or passage out of the Senate committee, we are actually pretty well positioned to be part of a public lands package if that comes together. So right now we're the furthest along that we have ever been in terms of the legislative process. The bill has changed significantly over these past three Congresses. We've taken sites out as Rick noted, we have adjusted the economic development boundaries, most of which are in the southern southeast area in Prince of Wales and also on QU Island near Cake. So none of the timberlands are near the Sitka area. So we've done a lot of adjustments in boundary. We've done a lot of adjustments in terms of public access. We've also, we didn't include, but the senator included in the Senate bill 150,000 acres of conservation lands. These are LUD-2 wilderness lands, and those are included in the Senate version of the bill. So that's one of the main differences between the Senate and the House bill. We continue to have ongoing discussions between us, Senator Murkowski, and Chairman Bingaman's staff, as well as other stakeholders, are providing their input to continually try to adjust the bill to address concerns. It's very difficult because we've been working on this so long, and I feel like sometimes we're giving and giving and giving and not getting much in return, but we're still going through that process where, and we still feel that the bill has significant benefits to Sea Alaska and its shareholders and to the region as a whole to allow us to maintain sustainable economic development in the region, to keep some of the timber industry jobs that we have that are dwindling every year, but also to give us opportunities to have other economic opportunities through all of our communities, and most importantly, to have ownership of some of our cultural sites. We don't know when a Senate markup might occur. They're in recess right now. We've heard potentially something in October, but we haven't any clue when something would happen. We also don't know when anything would happen in the House, despite some groups' blogs about the House bill moving tomorrow or next week on the suspension calendar. That's news to us because we met with Congressman Young last week, and he has no plans yet on when he's going to move it forward. So we're kind of waiting, just like everybody else, to see what's going to happen. And so that's kind of where we are in terms of status.
Thank you.
And I think just as a couple concluding comments is these kind of land bills don't get passed by themselves. They will be put together in a package, and it will be bills from New Mexico and Arizona and Montana will be put together in a package. And again, we don't really control that. The other part I'd like to make sure you know is this isn't the Sea Alaska bill. It's a bipartisan bill, but it's Senator Murkowski, Senator Begich's bill as the Alaska prime sponsors, and they make changes, and sometimes they tell us they're making changes. They say, "Do you like this?" And sometimes we say no, and sometimes we say we can live with it. I think one that we've recently dealt with, it's not in the legislation, but there is they've as much indicated to us that one of the issues and concerns with sacred sites is the possibility that those might interfere with sport fishing. And they've indicated to us that they will be putting a provision in there that will allow sport fishing on those sites.
We did clarify that it should be sport and subsistence fishing. We didn't want sport fishing to take priority over subsistence, and we also said it cannot harm the site. It cannot be in derogation of the site and its historical properties. So we did put our disclaimers on there that we want to make sure that these sites can still be protected, even though they could be used for some fishing opportunities.
But this is an example of there's this sort of constant evolution that this bill is, little changes are being made here and there and everywhere. And so for us, it's a little bit hard to even report what the status is because sometimes we don't know, and we don't know what the changes are because it ultimately is not our bill. They will come back and say, this is going to happen. We hope you agree with it. But that's part of the process, and so I just kind of wanted to stress that there are it's a continuing evolution of changes. This, the language that we've described to you isn't in writing on a bill. There's language that's sitting there that people say we will agree with this language, but they will have to go back and incorporate it into a new bill, and you know, and incorporate it as amendments to the bill. At this point in time, we ourselves don't quite know what the bill looks like, you know, because there's continuing discussions and negotiations with various parties over this thing. So I just want to say we're going to do everything we can to be as open and transparent, but it's a legislative process, and I describe it as when the going gets tough, the weird get going. It's an interesting process. But I think we were kind of chided for failing to kind of come over and explain to the city and the assembly what was happening. And I think we kind of felt that nothing had changed, so we weren't, and to that degree, we apologize, and that we should have been, you know, spending, you know, periodically making sure that we made contact here so that we could keep you informed. So with that, I do want to extend our apology in that case for not meeting that obligation.
And I just want to be clear, while the members come back, our delegation comes back to us with changes and we have to agree with them, so far the changes are stuff that we can live with. I wouldn't go so far to say that we're just going to take whatever they hand us if it's to a point where it's changed so much that it's not even going to accomplish our goals, and then I'm not sure that I could say that we would completely agree with it, but it is a process, and we're reviewing every change to make sure that it still allows us to meet our goals and the goals of the stakeholders involved.